Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series four of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. Once again, Adam Walker is alongside me, so sit back, relax, and we'll take things from here. This week, I am joined by Ravi Iyer, along with my co-host, Adam Walker, as always. Ravi is the clinical research director and founding partner, and also physician at the Iyer Clinic. So look, Ravi, I've given you a very brief intro there, but just having spoken briefly before we jumped on here, it sounds there's quite a bit to your background. So look, if you will, in your own words, give us a quick overview as to, yeah, your past experiences and yeah, who you are, what you do effectively.
Thank you, James. And hello, Adam. It's been a pleasure coming on your show. I am a physician primarily, but I'm also a scientist by training. I got my basic physician's degree back in India in 1983. It's a while ago, almost 40 years. And then went on to do the, you know, the various residencies and so on and so forth. And then took a big switch. I went into basic research, got a doctoral degree in biochemistry, molecular biology, and immunology at All India Institute in New Delhi. And from there, went over to Harvard as a postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Med School, with a dual appointment at the Med School as well as at the MGH Cancer Center. I was working under Kurt Isselbacher's department. And I was in that place, I was working primarily on the genes that regulate inflammation and repair. And we were working on a whole bunch of macrophage-specific receptors and cloning them, trying to develop different assay systems and so on and so forth. That work took me on to the Children's Hospital and Dana-Farber in Boston. And eventually, long story short, I was considered valuable enough for Harvard to sponsor me for my green card. I got my green card through Harvard. And in 1993 May, I got a clinical investigator award that required me to come to DC to get at the ceremony. And while I was presenting my work and getting that award, I bumped into the director of the residency program at GW. And it turned out that my work had validated something that he had postulated 20 years earlier and then given up because the tools were not there. And 20 years later, I happened to, with the benefit of new technology and tools, ended up proving his postulate. So he was obviously very excited and he offered me a residency program position. And I accepted, switched from Harvard, came to GW. I moved from leading a team of six people in research to being the lowly intern grunt, where my resident was 10 years younger than me and knew 20 years less than me. But I had to keep my mouth shut and go through it. And I had a wonderful mentor in residency, and he reminded me two things. He said, Ravi, the nail that stands up gets hammered down.
Indeed.
So he said, keep your head down. And then he also said, Ravi, remember, always be nice to nurses. Nurses like nice doctors, or they like single doctors. You are already married, so you better be nice. So, I mean, he was a very wise mentor. But anyway, bottom line, finished residency there. And at that time, research was getting a hit bad with grants. So I switched to basic primary care, moved to Northern Virginia from Washington, D.C., and started cold, hung up a shingle and started a practice. Looking back, if I knew how foolhardy I was, I may not have done that. I would have gone and joined a group. But I started out solo in a world where everyone was in big groups, and managed to survive from 1996 till 2012. I was solo. And then in 2012, I joined Loudoun Medical Group, which is the group which is dominant for most of Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. We are 300 plus physicians and nurse practitioners all combined. And we cover a catchment area of about almost 8,000 square miles from Alexandria County all the way to Culpeper in the west.
So your business is officially the Aya Clinic, and now you're part of the larger group, which is the Loudoun Group, which is what you're talking about here, yeah?
So Loudoun Medical Group is a multi-specialty group of physicians. It's completely physician-owned. Mm-hmm. We are about 40% of us are primary care, so about 60% are specialists. We all work under a single, we are administratively one unit, but each practice that joins is an independent practice, has to stand on its own legs, and each ship floats itself. So we are competitively separate, but administratively united. But the competition is a very much of a gentleman competition. We are, all the physicians in the Loudoun Medical Group are right at the top of the game. We are the best of in the nation. So it's, you know, I have a saying which I frequently say. It says, excellence never competes. There is, if you are the best, if you are really, really good at what you do, there is no sense of competition. The only competition you have is yourself. So excellence doesn't compete. And so all of a lot of medical group physicians are excellent in their field. We simply don't compete with each other. We don't need to. We are good enough that we stand alone and without any,
that motto, Ravi. I'm just wondering, I guess it's probably different for you folks in the States, because technically if physicians are to partner with other physicians, like patients are your customers, aren't they? So how does that work with perhaps, you know, referrals and things like that? As you mentioned, a gentleman's agreement. So how does that work in terms of that broader group-wise thing? This is me probably with, you know, my own business cap on, thinking, you know, I don't mind referring people away if it's not in our field, but do you have your individual niche then at the Aya Clinic, where other physicians would refer people to you and you do vice versa? Is that kind of how it works then?
So in the US, because we are such a big group and we pretty much cover almost all the specialties except for one or two, I tend to refer both inside the group and outside the group. My referral is based on only two criteria. The physician I'm referring to has to be really good. Mm-hmm. And care for my patient. So that's the number one criteria.
Yeah.
The next is the convenience for the patient. Like, for example, I have a patient who's living in the town of Herndon, but the Loudoun Medical Group's specialist who actually fits this particular referral is 20 miles away because we are such a large group. I cannot expect this patient to go all the way 20 miles over when there is an equally qualified specialist who's not part of Loudoun Medical Group 5 miles away from his residence. So I'll send him to the local. So those two factors, competency and convenience, the two C's of referrals. So that's basically what I do.
How's that changed for your business then, from being kind of that independent to now being part of the group where you have kind of access to that referral network, as it may be? Because
it must be
a big difference from being on your own, as you said, for so many years. How have things changed?
It's immense. The amount of ease with which I practice medicine completely transformed in the first day when I joined Loudoun Medical Group. See, when I'm part of Loudoun Medical Group, I don't have to worry about my IT infrastructure. I don't have to worry about my nothing on that. All of that is taken care of as part of the group. The group runs the entire physical, the central office takes care of all my business needs, including contract negotiation and everything. So I'm free to just focus on my patient. And yet my cost for that convenience is minimal compared to if I were to actually factor in, if I had to do it myself, not only would it be more expensive, it would be more burdensome and take me away from my primary competence, which is that of taking care of patients. I am far more effective as a physician being a part of such a well-managed group as opposed to doing it all by myself. So that's number one. Number two is the breadth and spread of the referral base that I have, and the fact that we all share a common electronic medical record. We use ECW, which is a popular EHR in the US. And so at any given time, if I happen to send a patient, that doctor doesn't need to bother me for records. All he has to do is log in and he can see everything that I am seeing on that patient. So, and the fact of a common EHR allows the group to also devote its resources to population health. They can see, okay, how many of our patients are missing certain essential preventive care services? You know, who are the ones who are the most likely to have a decompensation, who can fall ill due to a worsening of their chronic lung disease or their heart failure and so on and so forth. And can we intervene and try to keep them healthy and so on and so forth? And that is exactly one of the things we'll talk about today, is how we are planning on collaborating with some of the US-based vendors of data mining to actually help us in doing deep data analytics of our own patient population that we have not. So we don't need to build those resources in-house. We can actually get somebody in the area who will help us do that, and it will leverage into both sides of the coin, the therapeutic side as well as the research side.
Ravi, before we go into some of the detail of that, I'm just curious, how has the last couple of years of COVID impacted on that referral network? Because presumably people were not able to get in their cars and travel 20, 30, 40 miles down the road to a different physician. Was there an element of decentralized trials that was happening through networks and technology? I'm just curious about that, because as you were talking about it, it was resonating with me as well. And I'm just curious as to how you navigated that process.
So I'll talk about it from the perspective of delivery of clinical care versus delivery or execution of clinical trials. When it became apparent on March 10th, 2020, that we are in a pandemic, and a state of emergency was officially declared in the US. The rest of the world was a little earlier than that, but in the US, there was a formal official recognition that we were in a pandemic on March 10th. And we started testing on March 13th from that date. And so during the first 6 months, March, April, May, June, July, August, those 6 months was the roughest for the American healthcare and for Loudoun Medical Group as such. Practices who are not able to run had to shut down. our practice, the IR clinic was able to remain open every day during the entire pandemic. Not one day did we ever miss work. And that was because at that time we had access to sophisticated PPE, and I'll come into that, how we got access to that, that no other practice in the Northern Virginia, including hospitals, had at that time. So I could provide my staff with access to sophisticated PPE, some of which you're seeing hanging behind my shoulder, that people didn't have. And so we could continue operations. The clinical trial portion at that time, all the way till March of 2020, we were doing traditional clinical trials. People were coming into the office and doing, we had a pulmonary COPD, asthma COPD trial running. We had a diabetes trial running. And those trials essentially came to a halt because we were not equipped at that time to switch to a decentralized mode of clinical trials. So all of 1919, starting from this January 2020, all of 2021, right up to now, for these 2.5 years, our clinical trial activity kind of ground to a halt. And we are just now restarting it. Now we are restarting it for that. But prior to that, we were doing clinical trials nonstop from 2010. So we had 10 years before that. And then all of this was being done at the IR clinic, but we just had a big hiatus for 2.5 years where we are. And now we are aggressively going back and recruiting. And now we ramped up during the 2.5 years. We ramped up our ability to be a hybrid. And I think I don't believe that any site is going to be fully decentralized. It doesn't make sense. There are some parts of clinical trial where you have to lay eyes and hands upon the subject. You can't just do it all virtually. There is going to be someone meeting face to face with the person. Now, you may have that meeting place being at the site, or it may be at the person's place of residence, but still there is an actual face to face interaction. And then there are other portions that can be leveraged off into remote sensing, remote monitoring, and remote video conferencing modalities, and you can do all that. And basically, going forward now for the IR clinic, we are going to be doing trials as a hybrid. We are going to see patients on site. We are going to be doing it also off-site, either at the patient's location or using sensing tools to collect data.
Wow. So it's been a bit of a roller coaster then for the last couple of years, albeit you've managed to remain open, remain busy. What other challenges has that thrown up? And have you, I guess, managed to turn any of these obstacles into opportunities for yourself, Ravi? Because, I mean, I know that you and I spoke briefly before jumping on here about, you know, increasing the awareness of what you do. And you highlighted that there's kind of no point being excellent if nobody knows of you. So just talk to us about that piece for a second, because I quite liked that snippet of info that you gave us just before we jumped on the pod here.
So part of it is my temperament. I am in some ways blessed with an ability to pivot very easily. Mm-hmm. When I was in medical school, I had a nickname. My friends used to call me, they used a Hindi word for it. They used to call me water. That is, like water, I always find a way. I go around obstacles, go through it, go under or go over, but I don't get stopped. Mm-hmm. That's something that has been a hallmark of me as a person. And that's driven me all my life. So it's not a big deal. I mean, I'm not trying to be falsely modest about it. It's, you know, you can't be modest about something that is your basic character. That's my basic character. Mm-hmm. And I have never stopped. on something. I've always found some way of doing something. For me, an obstacle is just a call that circumstances are telling you to reorient. That's all. They're not out to stop you. They're not out to get you. The life is not out to get you ever. Life is just telling you that this path that you're on needs to be recalibrated or reoriented. That's all. And you just find that and then go along, go around without any hangover to whatever you had to give up along the way. So coming back to COVID and the first thing which we did was I sat down with my team. And so my approach was twofold. We talked about how do we give healthcare, since our clinic was doing both delivery of healthcare as well as research. And we sat down as a team and said, my staff said, how are we going to negotiate going forward? And I said that do you trust me to keep you safe? And if you trust me to keep you safe and you do what I do, I'll show you how to handle COVID. The only way to handle COVID is to face it head on. Mm-hmm. You can't run, you can't hide. And because in my past, I have worked with lethal or dangerous organisms. I have worked with tuberculosis. I have worked with leprosy hands-on. And so I'm comfortable. I know how to handle dangerous organisms. Mm-hmm. I know how to design systems to keep myself safe. And so I equipped my staff with that and showed them how to do it. We developed a very good system of keeping each other safe. And then from there, we were able to remain open and functional as a clinic. And because every other practice was closing down, our practice was mobbed.
Systems were in place, Ravi, if you were to just kind of a couple of them that you implemented where others maybe didn't, for example?
So I had a large supply of hazmat quality PPE, those moon suits, those astronaut suits. And that was because at the time when COVID hit, I was also the CEO of a company that manufactured some drugs that I had manufactured, that I had created. I had invented some medications that got FDA approved. And so we were making those, and we were equipped in the factory with all the hazmat required for safe making of FDA approved OTC products. So all I had to do was go into my factory and grab the equipment and repurpose it for my staff.
Wow. I'm sure there was a lot of business owners probably that I was speaking to at that point that would have loved to have been in that situation.
Yes, because we purchased all this in 2017, when all of this was so cheap in 2017. We purchased all this equipment in 2017, and then along comes 2020, where it was completely unavailable. So we were in a very blessed state in that sense. And we got, I equipped my staff with that. I showed them how to use it. We developed a buddy system where each person looked at the other person gowning and degowning, would spray disinfectant on each other before and after and all of that. And we had a very good system where each was the other person's safety link. And in this manner, a team of two or three, we would go out into the parking lot where we would test people and treat people out in their cars, or we would go to patients' homes who are actually COVID positive and were not well enough to go to the come to the clinic, but not sick enough to go to the hospital, and they were in this midway point. So we would go into the clinic, into their homes, treat them, and then undress and degown and trash our stuff in their driveway. Literally, we would undress in their driveway, and we had a complete changing outfit set up. We had a small tent made, a pop-up tent that people use in campsites to give some privacy for a shower. We use that pop-up tent as our private privacy, changing room. And we would set that up in the driveway and then go in and do it. We did that in nursing homes too. So all of that gave us a tremendous latitude and ability to deliver care. And because of that, patients started coming in. We were seeing as many as 60 to 80 patients a day in the clinic. It was unbelievable. And for that entire period, from March until December 24th, when I got my first shot of Pfizer vaccine, I would go home. I would degown in the garage, and then take a side entrance into my house and go to my basement where I lived apart from the family for that entire 10 months, because I didn't want to bring home to my family an infection that I was so freely embracing. So my wife and my wife was separate. I slept separate in my basement. We never saw each other except from a distance.
But for 10 months, it was solitary confinement then.
Yeah, 10 months of solitary. It was solitary warrior. It was a completely different mindset. And I'm actually very proud that the IR Clinic entire team did that. Every one of my team never falls sick, never, right up to the point they remained clean. And to this day, as of now, I have still not ever gotten positive for COVID.
Incredible.
And we have done about 35,000 tests in the 2.5 years, and about 10% of them have been positive. So about 3,500 patients, actual positives. And when we test, we get to 6 inches from their nose when they're putting them, and they sneeze upon us. They sneeze, they cough upon us. There's no 6 foot clearance when you're testing COVID. So you know, all of that is a different story from what I wanted to talk about with you, but that tells you the mindset of not just our clinic, but a lot of other primary care doctors. Loudoun Medical Group set up a huge tent outside their facility in Leesburg, where they were doing COVID tests for drive-through. So this entire, there were several major thrusts in Loudoun Medical Group that for COVID treatment and testing and screening. And we were at the vanguard. All of us were at the vanguard right at the beginning. And we are very lucky to be there. We were good and we were lucky. So I have no regrets at all about being part of a group that allowed all of us to function in such a massive healthcare crisis.
Definitely.
It's extraordinary as you described that, because it reminds us all, our listeners and James and I, exactly of, you know, the journey that we've been on throughout COVID, but also, you know, the best and the worst of times. Through adversity, it brings out the best in people, and sometimes it brings out the worst in people. But listening to you describe that, I hear the pride in your voice, but also I think it's very clear. I also have a number of very good friends who work in healthcare, one of whom has vaccinated over 50,000 people in the southeast of the UK. Yeah. She's never got COVID either, funnily enough.
I was thinking, hold up, this kind of reminds me of that story.
Exactly. Helen has never had COVID. She's done more than 50,000 vaccines. And she's an extraordinary woman. Similar to you, she has that absolute attention to detail, but also care for the human and the patient and the participant. And it really comes through in everything that you're describing as a physician, I think.
The one big thing that I was telling people, I told my clinic, I said that, listen to me, you got to understand, fear is the first contagion. Fear is the primary contagion. Actual disease comes afterwards. What is going to destroy people is fear. So the first thing you need to do is let them feel that they are safe. If you can't tell, I don't care how good a physician you are, how good a healthcare worker you are, if you cannot give them a space where they feel reassured and safe, then your technical brilliance, your diagnostic capability, your therapeutic skill is of no avail. You have to first and foremost remove the contagion of fear. And COVID was like when the air itself was toxic, when the normal movements that we do to reassure people, a hug, a touch, a peck on the cheek, when those things suddenly become a harbinger of a lethal disease, then human beings, the social fabric, the connection that we all have, we are connected people. We human beings crave contact. We wither and shrivel up when we are deprived of that. And that has been the real disease in COVID. The actual pathological phenomena of COVID is only mild. 10 times more is the psychological phenomena. And that has been the real challenge.
Incredible and inspirational stuff, Ravi. And just listening to how you explain this and kind of the energy with it, I just think that I don't know about you, Adam, with your local doctors or any other physicians you've dealt with personally, whether there's this level of kind of interest and excitement and kind of engagement. Well, I certainly have never experienced it. So, if you ever move over to the UK, I'll get signed up to your clinic. But where does this come from, Ravi, this mindset? And that you talked about it earlier about kind of being like water and being able to, always find a way. Where do you think that's come from? Because I always like to find out that from our guests on the show, whether it's been, I don't know, childhood experiences, parents, just, where has this kind of level of energy, work ethic and passion really for what you do, where does that come from?
I'm not unique. One of the things that I'm very proud of is that Loudoun Medical Group has many, many such doctors like the way I'm describing myself as. They are all passionate. Good doctors, especially if they are relieved of the burden of being a good doctor, the administrative burden, they naturally come out with passion in their work. I'll give you an example. You've seen SeaWorld, right? Nowadays, it is not very passe, but the orcas in SeaWorld, they are playful. Even though you have some accidents, but they are playful but in the actual wild, orcas are deadly, deadly hunters and predators. But when the orca's basic needs of food and hunger is taken care of, then the playfulness manifests. The fun part of. So similarly, also for physicians, when you relieve them of the burden of actually going through the administrative load of being a physician, their passion comes out. So you need to have a basic personality that loves being a physician. But there are a lot of passionate physicians. And usually, if you don't see them as passionate, they are usually burdened down and beaten down by the load of of surviving as a physician. So having said that, where I come from, I grew up in a family where actually I was trained to be a priest when I was a small kid. My family was a family of priests, and I went the other side and became a healthcare person. But the for me, being a doctor is no different than being a priest. You are dealing with the inmost ability of a human being to be vital and empowered. and they have the same roots. Historically, all the monks were healers too. You know, they all have the same roots. You cannot empower somebody without trying to set right whatever is ailing them. And life in my equation is that life is all about empowerment. What else is it? There is nothing else. You go through life empowering people, and they and get empowered by that process yourself. I am successful in what I do. I am rewarded handsomely for what I do, but that is not the primary driver. What is the primary driver is my ability to empower. And that is exactly what I do in my work, whether it is with the patient or with my team or whether it is my research team. It is always the same. How do you empower? How do you make them solve the problem that is blocking them from moving forward? And therein comes the same skill that I have, as it is, you meet an obstacle and you work around it. You initially it stops you. All obstacles stop you. Initially, especially really meaningful goals, you will meet meaningful obstacles. And this, even in research in Loudoun Medical Group, we first approached this at the group level in 2012. When I first joined, we tried to do it and it fell apart because there was the infrastructure was not there. We did not have a common EHR at that time. There was a lot of skepticism about among doctors. Really, I don't want to get into the research side. I just want to see my patients and go on and things like that. And I was the champion. I was the cheerleader for the research effort back in 2012. And after struggling for 12 and 13, I said, you know what? I'm going to back off right now. I'm just going to focus on having my site come up. Mm-hmm. And waited for a full 10 years doing my site, talking about it internally, showing people how it works, all right, and how we are able to succeed. And then finally, the group as such is saying, you know what, we want to get trained too. We want to go and do our GCP. We want to do our city program training and get ourselves. And we have now a program of doing clinical training, clinical research coordinators in-house, hiring people from outside. And in this process, moving the whole group practice by practice. In we actually have now a roster of, right now on our pipeline, we have about 6 individual physicians and 6 practices in on the pipeline, get ready to get trained and be credentialed and made what we call clinical research competent in the next 6 to 7 months.
Wow. So you've been driving the charge on that, and it's kind of been 10 years in the making then by the sounds of things, but it's now point where you're like, okay, we can do it. I can teach others. I can bring more people into the industry and kind of spread that awareness. Hence, you know, kind of why I reached out to you and wanted you to share almost that exact story, Ravi, because I think I had come across something from you on LinkedIn. So I wanted to learn more about it.
So one of the big things that we have now that we did not have then was, back in 2012, I was the lone charger. I had administration who the business suits in the organization understood the value, but I did not have buy-in at a very high leadership level from the physician side.
Yeah.
What made a big difference was my boss is the chief medical officer, the medical director for Loudoun Medical Group, a very forward-thinking gentleman, a doctor, senior doctor by the name of Dr. Neil Foster. He is with me this time, which I didn't have. So that brings you know, one of the key elements when you have a major undertaking like this is you can't do it alone. You have to have some shared community citizenship. There needs to be other people, other stakeholders who share your vision. And having Dr. Foster, you know, kind of support and also steer my enthusiasm, because I can be very, very fast. I have a tendency to move quickly because I see opportunity, I go. Yeah. And sometimes when you're working with a huge, and that's what I say, how do you get an elephant to dance? Very, very slowly. You know, that's, you know, 1 foot at a time. you try to do too many, you'll topple over. So, Dr. Foster helps me in that sense. Something that I never had before. And for the first time, this time around, we actually have a team, which it took 10 years in the making for me to get that. And now it's like every week we are actually having a milestone ahead. Every week we are getting a new milestone. So that's something that is extremely exciting and exhilarating. It must
feel so rewarding for you, having kind of been there, done it, kind of almost faced the struggles yourself, to now have correct. That support network around you saying, yes, look, not just you need to do it, we're going to do it. So yes. Yeah, must be really exciting, Ravi. And like, you know, things are changing week by week. I mean, just let us know. I mean, what are things looking like over the next 6 months or a year for both the Aya Clinic and Loudoun Medical? What does the future look like?
So for this, my timeline is in quarters, 3 months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
My goal in the next 3 months is we are going to team up with a data analytic data mining company that focuses primarily on helping physician groups mine their data using their proprietary artificial intelligence, natural language processing technology.
Mm-hmm.
This company was actually featured on your podcast a little while ago. The Sieve Health.
Oh, okay, Arty, yeah.
Yeah, Arty.
Amazing so, tool.
Yeah, and she. It was totally fortuitous on LinkedIn. It was, she just tagged me and shot a query across, and immediately I sensed something, and I shot back, said I want to learn more, and then we had a conversation, and now we are moving forward with so in the next 3 months we are probably going to try to find, if not Sieve Health, some other. But the goal is very simple. It's going to be a data analytics drive. We don't know which company we would actually end up with, but I hope we can find a good fit for our group and then move from there.
I'm sure once we get the data, could have some input on that as well.
Yeah, I would look forward to that. Once we get data analytics laid in, we are going to turn right around and present our information or the results of that to both the CROs and the other stakeholders on the sponsor side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also going to use the same data analytics with conventional insurers that pay for healthcare, because that data as to how many diabetics we have, how many of them are on metformin, how many of them have cardiac disease, how many of them have vascular disease, how many of them had hospital, all of that data has population health implications, and it has research recruitment implications.
Hmm.
So I see data as a huge resource that can be used for different channels of purpose for both sides of the equation. And the Dr. Foster, my boss, runs the population health section, and I run the research, and we are hand in glove in this manner of driving our way forward with data. So on one side, these next 3 months is going to be getting data, setting in place the analytics portion of our venture, and assembling that. The second part is the human part. The delivery part is we need to get our physicians trained and motivated. So both Dr. Foster and I are going to go practice by practice. We have budgeted 2 hours on 2 days a week, lunch hour, 12 to 2. We will actually be going out to one practice at a time along Loudoun Medical Group, meeting them face to face, talking to them about the opportunity of clinical research, collecting from them their anxieties and their hesitances. What is actually blocking them? Would they be open to getting support in developing clinical research capacity in their practice? So that is that side. Then on the central Loudoun Medical Group side, we already have a team of IT people. We have a team of nurses, supervisors who can oversee practices who are doing the execution of trials and make sure that they are adhering to quality. Our internal audit team, that is what we do. We do that in population health. We are going to do that in research also. So it's a three-pronged effort. The data side and the sponsor side is one side. The physician capacity and capability is one side. And then the supervision, quality, QA, QC, quality assurance, quality control, aspect is one side, or what you guys talk of as risk-based monitoring and so on and so forth. But essentially, it is just QAQC. So that is basically what. So that is my those are the three buckets of effort. And my next 3 months are going to be focused on building the infrastructure of that. The next 3 months after that is trial startup. So we are looking at August, September, October. And then November, December, such that by January, we should be starting our first round of trials. And then comes simultaneously trial oversight while we continue to expand capability. So it is just, you know, rinse, repeat. And
yeah, getting into that rhythm. And
Yeah, that's all.
Amazing.
So it's a very, very clear-cut path forward that we are just talking about it, and you know, talking to you, talking to RT, talking to other people in this field. We're just getting the first, literally at the ground level, and there seems to be no stopping this at this time.
Amazing. Ravi, as you were describing that, Ravi, I was filled with loads of different thoughts and questions, but clearly you have an impression or an idea of what that value might come from that data. And I'm assuming this is from your own collaborative EHRs, electronic health records, that you've sustained at the moment over many years of successful recruitment. What do you think that's going to play out to look like? I mean, it sounds also like you're very busy already. So is there a growth component to this based upon the success of the AI machine learning that's going to drive the outcomes of that data?
So there are two ways which we already at the leadership level, we already talked about it internally. One is build and another is buy. So how much of these infrastructures can we build ourselves and at what rate? And we definitely are going to build. So there's no denying the fact that we will be doing our own internal training, and we'll be trying to train and grow our own research coordinators from our internal pool of motivated candidates. We have quite a few in that category. The other thing is Bai, and in Bai, the two of the low hanging fruit that we are probably going to definitely hire are CRCs, fully trained CRCs, who can hit the ground and start running. That is probably going to arrive somewhere close to the point when we are in the process of doing our first budget and contract negotiations with a trial, and that is when we are probably. So I foresee that happening in the second quarter of this entire project. So, around January or February of next year.
Mm-hmm. Sensible game plan, Ravi. It sounds like you've got that long-term goal then mapped out for the future, but you're working in those 90-day sprints of each component. Correct. And you visualized it. And I think that is where, you're more likely to have success, because you've broken down the vision into manageable tasks, and you just need to tick the box every step of the way.
That exactly. And along the way, we might have to recalibrate and pivot and change strategies. We don't know. This is our best case scenario as we see it now. And every month, every 3 months, we may say, that original idea is not going to work. We're going to have to change.
Again, you have to adapt. We've discussed that several times already, haven't we? So that's just how it goes sometimes.
Yeah, and that happens all the time, because that's just the nature of reality. Life shows you all the time what works and what doesn't, and you just learn that and then move on.
Most definitely. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. I know that you and I will, of course, stay in contact in line with some of those plans, and perhaps get you back on the show to detail how it's all gone. Has it been a success? What obstacles did get thrown up? But look, before we close the show, Ravi, we always roll off a few quick fire questions. So I'll kick us off here just before we let you go. And that is you've clearly been in the industry long enough, racked up quite a few achievements. But what is the one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self?
Don't be in a rush. That for me has always been the most difficult thing, because if people who are creative, who can think and see possibility, are frequently overwhelmed by their own creativity, by the imperative of their own creativity to rush forward into the unknown. And one thing that I have learned over time, painfully sometimes, is that no accomplishment is created on the shoulders of one person. Buy-in is important, and it does not matter that the other people don't see your vision. It is your job to help them see it. And you can't afford the arrogance of saying, they're dumb. They're not dumb. If somebody can't see your vision, it is you who are dumb for not being able to make them see it. That is the one most important thing that you need to learn in life.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
Ravi, you show such humility and wisdom in everything that you say. And I'm just wondering where you go for that wisdom, because our listeners and our followers always love to know what the people are listening to, the books or resource they've got on their bedside table. I wonder what's on your bedside table, Ravi.
Quite a lot, actually. But there was a book called On Change Management, or written by I'm blanking out on it. It's a wonderful book that allowed me to see how change is not created by one person, but most importantly, it is life itself that teaches me everything. My patients teach me, and where I go for this, when I'm talking face to face, my what you call humility comes out. I'm also equally accused of being very brash and very, very in your face, cocky, if you can call it. The truth is, I know that life is a lot bigger than any one person, any one person's in vision. Whatever I see today, whatever I see as possible for Loudoun Medical Group or for my own practice will not last many years after my demise. It's not something that, you know, you look at Alexander, right? He conquered the whole world. How much of whatever he did lasts? You know, Genghis Khan, the great Caesars and the great emperors of the world. None of their monuments last, except a few pieces of architecture here and there. The key thing that really lasts is what they transformed in somebody else's life. That resonates from life to life to life. And that's the best you can hope from whatever you do. You know, that's all I see in my life. What I do is because I love doing this. This is my way of expressing who I am. But I'm not here to create an empire, except maybe a memory of what we were able to achieve as a group, as an individual, in the long story of healthcare in this country. That's all.
Sure. So look, on that subject of creating an empire or creating a team, if you were to name just three qualities that you value most when putting those teams together, so whether it's going to be these physicians, CRCs, whatever it might be, what is the individual qualities that you would call upon as a top three?
Honesty. You have to be honest to your team. You have to tell them, you have to show them that you don't know all the answers yourself, but that you are always willing to put yourself up front and that you will take the cost of failure on your shoulders all the time. Mm-hmm. That is something that you absolutely have to do with every team. You can't be the person who says you failed. No, the nobody gets up in the morning planning to fail. Nobody ever says, you know what, I'm going to go and mess up something or screw up something today. Nobody does that. They get up doing the best they can and things don't work out. The only thing I ask somebody when they make a mistake is, do you know what to do now? Mm. And if they are able to say that, then that's fine. Then let's go do it. That's all. We'll mop up. We will clean up the mess and then we won't do it. That's all. That's the best that you can ask from anybody. That is excellence. Mm. Excellence is not getting it right. Excellence is being able to mop up and not do it again. That's all. That is excellence. People don't get this. Be honest and learn what excellence is about. And then at all times, when it comes to recognition, put the team forward. The team gets the recognition. You stand back. If you want to lead, push the team forward. Create the scenario for the team to win always. When the team wins, then automatically the team will turn around and clap for you. But you don't need to stand out there and say, hey, clap for me, clap for me. You don't need to do that.
Ravi, you must have seen our promo vids before, because the responses you're giving here could just all be individual promo bits for us. So look, I won't push you on too many more. You've given us a great answer there. And as I say, I'm sure that will feature in our little promo vid for this piece. If it doesn't, I'll be shocked.
I'll move on to
Adam for the next question.
I give that a thumbs up as well, James, by the way. I think you've touched on so many nuggets of wisdom today, Ravi. But is there something outside of work that you particularly enjoy that isn't necessarily work related? Where can we find you spending your spare time?
Dogs.
We've got that in common then.
I train police dogs championships. Wow. So I I raise German Shepherds from eight. I don't breed, but I get them when they are 8 weeks old, puppies, and then I raise them, I train them. I compete in police dog style sports, something that's called Schützen. So it is a three-phase sport. The dog has to track, it has to do obedience, and it has to do protection work. So that's, you know, searching out for a bad guy and then guarding him. And when he tries to escape, chasing him, biting him and pulling him down and you know, doing all that stuff. And on a single command, when I say out, will release and then stand there guarding the guy.
That sounds like a podcast all of its own.
Yeah, that sounds incredible.
The rest of my doctors go and play golf. I play with dogs.
Brilliant stuff. And look, finally, you know, you've touched on it a little bit here already, but what would you say is your number one golden rule for life and business if you were to snap that up in a short sentence? Put you on the spot now, haven't we?
Number one. don't take yourself too seriously. That's all.
I think it's a good one. I think we've heard that a few times because, again, you've got to enjoy life. Look, we all do a lot, but, you know, it's kind of, you got to do what you do, but enjoy the process, don't you? And kind of be able to hold your hands up if you've messed something up and just, yeah, kind of, yeah, enjoy it.
I don't take myself seriously. I think you should be able to laugh and you should be able to, you know, it's easy when you are very good at what you do. It's easy when you're successful to think that you are bigger than yourself. It's very easy because you have so many people looking at you and saying, oh, you're so good, and all that. It's easy, but it's not real. At the end of the day, I still occupy only 5 feet, 6 inches on the bed. I eat only 3 meals a day. And you know what? My wife still doesn't give me any respect.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, Ravi. Well, you clearly are a character. You clearly don't take yourself too seriously. But for anyone wanting to reach out to you, the Aya Clinic, find out more about the group, you know, what is the best way to reach out to you, get hold of you, contact you, etc.?
Oh, just D-R-I-Y-E-R, Dr. Iyer at ayerclinic.com. You can shoot me an email. It comes directly to me. I'll always respond. That's it.
Perfect. And look, we'll also kind of share your links on the podcast. So anyone wants to check you out on LinkedIn, etc., we'll do all of that. But look, for now, Ravi, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thanks very much again for sharing your story on the Huxley Morton podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having it. It's a really enjoyed the time I spent with Adam and you.
Good stuff.